Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new monthly edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes today. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is the Bloomberg Daybreak Asia podcast. I'm Doug Krisner. You can join Brian Curtis and myself for the stories making news and moving markets in the APAC region. You can subscribe to the show anywhere you get your podcast and always on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business app.
It's the Bank of Japan Day, day two of the meeting, and we will get some policy pronouncement coming up a little bit later this morning. Joining us in our studios in Singapore to talk about this is Pei Qian Liu, who is Asia economist at Fidelity International. So we might get a little bit of a change in terms of the inflation expectations from the BOJ, but at least most BOJ watchers are saying there won't be any policy change. Are you in that camp, or do you see perhaps a change in policy?
First, thank you for having me today. I also expect the BOJ to keep monetary policy rates and policy setting unchanged in this meeting. The reason being there has been a slew of actions being taken last month where the BOJ officially exited its negative interest rate regime. For this month, I think the focus will largely be, as you mentioned earlier, on the revision of inflation for the BOJ's quarterly outlook report that's going to be published. We also get a new fiscal year 26 inflation. And we expect all of the inflation forecasts to be anchored around or above 2% for the next 3 years.
What's going on with the currency right now? And should this be of great concern for the Bank of Japan? Or are they? Do you think they're comfortable with allowing market forces to dictate where the yen is trading and perhaps import a lot more inflation into the economy?
Well, I think just broadly put into perspective, the weakening Japanese yen is a result of the strong dollar rally over the past few sessions. So broadly, not only the Japanese yen, Chinese yuan and other Asian FX are also facing pressure of depreciation over the repricing of Fed rate path and also the dollar strength. So on that note, I think as long as Japanese yen is not singled out in a depreciation path, the BOJ or the MOF might be observing the pace of depreciation rather than a specific level of it. Speaking of weak yen's impact on the economy, I think definitely we're seeing more rising imported inflation that's contributing to the CPI numbers. But given that the BOJ is still firmly pushing for its reflation of the economy and trying to get inflation back to above 2% in a more sustainable manner. So I wouldn't really think that having a little bit of imported inflation is bad for the economy after all.
Yeah, exactly. It sort of helps them with their objective. But it seems like here of late, you've seen a lot more discomfort coming in. The stock market hasn't responded as it often responds to a weak yen by going higher. It's been a little bit troubled. And you're hearing more and more of these threats from policymakers that they could intervene. Now, I didn't think that it would be very likely that they would intervene in these 2 days where the Bank of Japan was meeting. But then Bloomberg did a story saying history suggests that they are willing to do it. It doesn't happen all that often, but they are willing to do it. But I guess we're about ready to get this decision. So at least so far, no intervention. Going forward, who knows?
Yeah, again, I think from a coordination or policy regime perspective, definitely the BOJ meeting today is worth watching out for, especially what Governor Ueda's messaging about the weak Japanese yen is, and whether or not that affects the BOJ's forecast for inflation trajectory. So I think that will be also affecting the Japanese yen performance after the meeting and will probably influencing the MOF's decision on whether or not they should or would be intervening in the market.
You also mentioned a weak Chinese currency, and the export side of the China story has been one area of the economy that's been holding up pretty well. Do you expect that to continue?
Well, I think the export, some of somewhat of an outperformance in the past few months is mainly driven by a resumption or resilience of the developed markets demand. So that was in line with hot data showing that the demand and export cycle is turning in an upswing. So from that perspective, I think, yes, we probably will see a continuation of this, especially with the pickup of semiconductor supply chain as well as the goods exports. But having said that, I think ultimately, China's growth still should likely to be domestically driven, which is still somewhat in a gradual recovery path. So that's why in our base case, we think that China's growth this year most likely will fall in the range of controlled stabilization rather than any strong reflation driven by added domestic or external demand at this moment.
So in the U.S., and now you look at the U.S. as well, GDP rising an annualized 1.6%, trailing every forecast in a Bloomberg survey, and inflation a lot hotter than expected, 3.7%. Is this still sort of in the noise category, or is this a trend now that we really have to be cognizant of?
Well, I think for the U.S., our base case is that it's gradually becoming the case that soft landing becomes more likely. There are some resilience in the U.S. economy being exhibited, for example, a somewhat resilient labor market, inflation print still hovering at somewhat elevated levels. So that all gives us a signal that with this resilience, it's really the case that the U.S., that the Fed might be holding its rate for a bit longer.
Yeah. All right. Ms. Liu, thank you very much for joining us. Liu Peiqian there, Asia economist at Fidelity International.
The Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin. Investment professionals reveal their best mentors, how they find their next great idea, and a few funny stories. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Talked a lot about tech earnings this morning. We want to get a closer look at some of the ins and outs with Robert Lee, Bloomberg Intelligence senior analyst. So I know that some of these companies, Robert, are not companies that you cover specifically. So we want to talk, I guess, more in generalities about the impact on companies here, perhaps that you do follow, a company like Tencent in the tech sphere. So we had very strong earnings from Alphabet and Microsoft. The stocks rewarded. Meta, parts of Meta's earnings were pretty solid, particularly the profit and revenue in the prior quarter. But it's the forecast that got them in trouble. So, what are some of the what are you gleaning from some of these earnings? And let's throw in as well Hynix yesterday, and you know what we heard from TSMC and others like TI.
Okay. Not much to go through then, but let's I'll do my best.
Yeah, give you 30 seconds.
Okay. It's all AI. It's all going up, but I'm joking. I think taking a step back and looking at common themes that impact both the US that have relevance to the Mag 7 and also the stocks here in Asia. I think maybe, as I've said before, most people would agree, as we do, that the secular trend in AI is something that's going to, it's a multi-year trend, arguably a multi-decade trend. The benefits to consumer and enterprise clients are potentially significant over the long run. Who's making money from it in the moment, though? Clearly, NVIDIA and the infrastructure players are. And, you know, NVIDIA's really in the sweet spot, winner takes it all because of the supply constraints. However, you look at the software companies in the middle, and they are shelling out tens of billions in capex at a time when their monetization strategies are at an early stage or even immature. And I think that chickens came home to roost, if that's the right expression for Meta on that front, because its capex burden is rising, impacting its free cash flow generation at a time when its monetization is relatively low.
Right.
And obviously, investors took that quite negatively.
So the CapEx, though, I would argue, is tied not only to AI, but VR as well. And we know that Zuckerberg is very much committed to kind of the metaverse and the virtual reality space. But let's, for the sake of this discussion, remain focused on AI. One of the things that you highlighted there was the accelerators made by NVIDIA, and that's not the only part of the AI story when you're building out these data centers. The memory chip makers, the high bandwidth memory chip makers in particular, are benefiting in a big way. Next week, we're going to get Samsung. Can you give me a sense of what to expect, what we might look for in the Samsung numbers?
No, definitely. So the major suppliers, the three main memory suppliers globally, Samsung being the largest, SK Hynix in Korea, and then Micron in the States. So whilst Samsung is the leading volume player with a large exposure and dependence on the PC market, the leader in high bandwidth memory, which goes into these AI servers, is Hynix. So Samsung is playing catch up. And I think the thing to watch for in next week's results is, you know, what progress are they making on that front? Are they managing to narrow the gap with the leader Hynix? But DRAM, or the memory chips, is a notoriously volatile market. Things seem to be going the right way for the moment as PC demand picks up, and the dynamics of supply and demand move more in their favor. But having said that, look at Intel last night. Intel clearly disappointed. One of the reasons for that is ongoing soft demand within mainstream PCs. So we shouldn't forget about that at the moment.
I thought that this earnings season, we might see a switch from the providers of the AI chips, the focus on them, more into use case, the software and the consumer-facing companies like Google and perhaps even Microsoft. I'm not sure that we're quite there yet, but might we get teased some of that from Samsung?
Again, you look at Samsung's business, the major profit and earnings drivers for it are the memory chips. So again, DRAM and NAND flash, which are very, very cyclical and very, very volatile industries. But with demand currently beginning to outstrip supply, that's pushing pricing up and driving margins within those core businesses. Samsung's also a major supplier of smartphones globally. That's a sort of lower growth business these days. So the thing to watch for Samsung's results next week are really the memory side. That's what underpins their profit growth. And as I said, we need to see evidence that they are narrowing the technology gap with the leader Hynix at the moment. So I think it's all in potentially in Samsung's favor on that front. The other thing very quickly is greater focus on shareholder returns, enhanced shareholder returns. Obviously, Samsung is sitting on a substantial cash balance, is inherently very cash generative. Could we see, you know, enhancements on the shareholder return side, as we saw from Google last night with its inaugural dividend?
Before we let you go, Robert, I'm sorry to cut you off there, because I want to be able to get your perspective on the Chinese chip manufacturers. The Huawei, I think, has come into sharp focus, given you just mentioned the smartphone market. Huawei is, I think, doing very well on that front. What do we know about chip manufacturing going on in China right now, and whether or not companies like Samsung need to look over their shoulder?
It's probably a little bit early days for Samsung and others to worry about the threat from the Chinese. But at the end of the day, the weight of the state is backing Huawei and SMIC, and SMIC being the Chinese equivalent of TSMC. So you've got a lot of national pride, a lot of strategic national long-term objectives, and a lot of money flowing into that sector. However, they have two major barriers to overcome. One is the export restrictions on the ASML advanced lithography equipment. That is going to be a multi-year challenge for them to overcome. And the yields they're generating on these 5-nanometer chips, which is the one that caught the headline at the end of last year, they look to be quite low. So they are making progress, but they're multiple, well, three, four generations behind where the US and TSMC is at the moment.
Do you see the heat getting turned up in the relationship between U.S. and China when it comes to things like semiconductors, or do you see that heat perhaps being lowered in the next few months?
Again, another great question. I think China's strategy at the moment is these restrictions on the lithography equipment are not impacting the mainstream. And obviously, China is the workshop to the world, isn't it? They make everything from vacuum cleaners to air conditioning units. These use mainstream chips. And China's strategy at the moment seems to be increasing its market share within the mass market, which does not suffer these restrictions. That's the strategy. At the same time, putting a huge amount of effort onto the R&D side, but that's a multi-year challenge.
I know you have to run off to television, much in demand. Robert, thank you. Robert Lee, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Analyst. Secretary of State Antony Blinken raising concerns over what the U.S. perceives as unfair trade practices in China. And the Global Times, a Communist Party paper, responded by saying, why does the U.S. side turn a normal visit into what seems like an ultimatum? Joining us now is Jill Desis in our studios right here in Hong Kong, Bloomberg News desk editor, to take a closer look. There wasn't all that much that came out of these meetings yesterday, except kind of restating positions, I would say. What do you say?
Yeah, Brian, I agree with you. I think that makes sense, though, here, because really what Blinken is doing here is just driving home this drumbeat of criticisms that the U.S. has been building, particularly over the last several months against China. So one is this criticism of industrial overcapacity that the U.S. has levied against China, the idea that China is exporting incredibly cheap goods around the world and creating a lot of economic imbalances. We saw this come up during U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen trip to Beijing just a couple of weeks ago, Blinken hitting on that again during this trip to Shanghai and Beijing. The other thing, too, though, is that he's, when it comes to some of those unfair trade practices, a major point of contention is China's relationship with Russia and how much China may be, funding different, industries within Russia that are contributing to the war efforts in Ukraine. This is also, I will say, Brian, just something that came up with Janet Yellen. It's you sort of raised the prospect that there could be fresh sanctions on Chinese banks helping Russia in that respect. So lots going on here.
It's not just Russia. The sanctions on the Chinese banks also tied to this flow of Iranian crude oil that has been going to the refineries in China. That seems to be pretty real because it was baked into this foreign aid bill. I'm sure that that was talked about in this meeting. And I'm wondering that supposing that it's not going down very well in Beijing.
No, Doug, I don't think it is. I think you're right that, it's difficult to think that that wouldn't be discussed during all these meetings with Blinken this week. I think it really just underscores this idea that there's still a lot of points of contention and a lot of room for volatility within the U.S.-China relationship because you've got, yes, all of these, dignitaries from the U.S. visiting China recently. That's certainly an improvement from where we were just, a year or 18 months ago when you saw a much bigger icing out of communications. So there's at least that resumption of high-level talks between U.S. and Chinese officials. But as we've seen with a lot of, the responses, particularly from the U.S. recently on potential sanctions, on different aspects of China, there's still a lot of points of contention here.
Yeah, I was looking for a way to finish off our story that we wrote for the radio earlier. And it seemed that, you could say that although to a certain degree, the relations have stabilized, but the two countries are still battling over technology, human rights, trade, Ukraine, North Korea, and the Middle East. So I was curious what Jill Desis thinks is, what's the sorest of the points?
I mean, I think at this point, really, a lot of those issues over tech and national security in particular are very, very difficult. I'm looking over the last year where I think the Biden administration has been the most effective in really crimping a lot of China's ambitions is on some of those technological issues. I mean, we've seen some fairly effective sanctions on chip makers and, on chip supply chains directed at China that I think have really created some pain points. Obviously, China has found some ways to sort of work around those things. We saw that, big Huawei phone launch last fall that was, very successful. But it's very clear, especially when you're seeing this brought up in Xi Jinping, addresses and things by other Chinese leaders, that this idea that, China is very concerned about ways in which it sees the U.S. as, really, really crimping a lot of its technological ambitions. And I think that's a particular sore point.
Crippling technological innovations, perhaps, but certainly standing in the way of a lot of what Beijing would like to do in the South China Sea. I think we can agree on that as well, don't you think?
Definitely. I mean, look, I think that, you know, military defense issues are certainly a major sticking point here. I mean, it's really, you have to go back to Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan when she was a U.S. House Speaker, really kicked off, you know, quite a bit of anger from Beijing. I mean, you know, just a few months later, we had the alleged Chinese spy balloon flying over the U.S. that actually iced an earlier trip Blinken was supposed to take to China last year. I mean, yes, it's very clear that I think, you know, anything involving the U.S.'s support of Taiwan in particular is going to be a major sticking point with Beijing and create some additional volatility there.
In our BN story on this, we didn't mention about a possible meeting with President Xi Jinping. Is that seemingly now off the table, or might it happen today?
I think, Brian, we're really not going to know until really the last minute here. I mean, it's certainly possible. And remember, Blinken did meet with Xi last year when he was in town. So, you know, there's certainly precedent there. I'd say it's still floated as a possibility, but it may not be until quite late this afternoon that we actually get some kind of confirmation on whether that meeting is actually taking place.
Okay, Jill, 30 seconds. Did they talk about TikTok?
I mean, it's got to come up, right? Like, I mean, when you've got this massive, you know, U.S. legislation that's just passed, 270 days to divest or to leave the U.S. I mean, again, another really just underscoring a lot of that major points of contention there.
Yeah, they went to a basketball game the night before. I mean, yesterday was the first full day of meetings, and that's kind of interesting. So Anthony Blinken getting a little culture there in China. Jill, thanks so much for joining us here in our studios. Jill Desis, Bloomberg News Desk Editor.
This has been the Bloomberg Daybreak Asia Podcast, bringing you the stories making news and moving markets in the Asia Pacific. Visit the Bloomberg Podcast channel on YouTube to get more episodes of this and other shows from Bloomberg. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen, and always on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business App.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.